2005, and this is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee for Human Services. Today we'll be hearing public testimony and a public hearing on House Bill 5052, which is the and House Bill 5053, both deal with the Board of Nursing. And we'd like to begin with Jim Gores.
Yes.
So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Gores, for the record. I'm with DAS Budget and Management. The presentation you have before you, I don't have it quite as nice as they've got it up behind you, so you're going to unfortunately have to look at the paper here. I think Deborah just handed that out. But anyway, I'm just going to go a very quick high-level overview of the budget for the Board of Nursing. On page 3, you'll see that of all the consumer and business services program area, this agency has about 1.1% of the full budget related to this program area. On page 4, this board fit into the governor's principal budget under the health and basic needs principle. And then on page 5, for other funds, this agency, for the total funds, they have a $9.1 million budget according to the governor's recommended budget, and that is all other funds. And primarily their revenue comes from licensing fees, which you can see about $8.5 million of that. And then as proposed in their budget, they also have, I believe it's now around $700,000 proposed for fingerprinting fees. There's also a certified nursing assistant piece, which I'm sure the agency will talk about later, that is part of this budget. On page 6, there's no real program breakdown. All funds go into just the general nursing licensing of nurses program. And then on page 7, it's a breakout of the services and supplies and personal services for this agency. About 63% of their expenditures in personal services and 37% is in services and supplies. On page 8, once again, just kind of a breakout of how their spending is. As you can see, once again, just all other funds. And you can see a change from the 03-05 budget of about 14.7%. And also down there below, you can track the historical trend of their positions and their full-time equivalent, or FTE. Finally, on page 9, major policy issues for these folks. One of the large ones is the nursing shortage. It impacts not just their licensees, but the board themselves. They have a hard time recruiting at times for positions within their agency due to the nursing shortage. They have a workplace issue, which I think it's policy package 101 we'll be dealing with. They have an investigations backlog, which I believe policy package 102 works to address, and we'll talk about that further. And demand for new ways to deliver constituent services. This agency is the first agency that I'm aware of that has gone into e-commerce, and so they allow their licensees to renew online, which has been a fabulous thing. But at the same time, that also creates new issues for them. And then societal crime rates, which I believe is package 103 deals with for fingerprinting. A lot of the folks that the nurses deal with and work with are very vulnerable, and so they're proposing doing some background checks to help decrease the vulnerability of those folks in that work environment. And so that is it. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll be happy to turn it over to Joan.
Okay, I have questions relating to the workspace and questions relating to the $500,000 on background checks. So should those be addressed to you or to...
I'd be happy to try and answer them. I might suggest, if it's okay, that we will. I know they're planning to discuss those policy packages individually, and at that point it might... It might help answer some of your questions.
That's fine.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I see no questions, so Joan.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. I'm Joan Bouchard. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and to my left is Pat Miles, who is the Business Manager for the Board of Nursing. We were here a couple of weeks ago and talked to you about part one, which we included about the mission and the agency programs, our performance measurements, lots of performance measurements at that time, and the agency priorities and our 10% reduction. So now, today, we're here to talk to you about part two. We also, at your seat, we have given you information that was requested at our first meeting with you. We hope that that will answer the questions that you had, and if it doesn't, we will be glad to provide additional information. Part two begins with what are the major budget drivers and environmental factors for the Board of Nursing, and the one primary major budget drivers and environmental factors that we have been dealing with for the last 2 years is, of course, the nursing shortage. There is a significant nursing shortage of both nurses and nursing assistants in Oregon. The reasons for this are multidimensional, but the outcome is clear that we don't have enough available workforce to meet the demands for the nursing services in the state of Oregon. The shortage is not primarily the result of reduced supply of nurses, but it's also a consequence of increased demand for people needing health care and nursing services. There's new and evolving roles for nurses and nursing assistants. And there, of course, as you all know, the increase in the population in Oregon, the increase in the older population of Oregon, which leads to increase in chronic diseases, all of those add up to an increased need for health services and nursing services. So at the same time that the demand is increasing, the supply of nurses has been decreasing. There are fewer people entering into the nursing profession. One of the reasons for that is the opportunities for women outside of nursing have expanded. There's many more options for young women. And so we found that the number of people entering the nursing profession had declined. At the same time, the current nursing workforce was steadily aging. During the next decade, the largest group of nurses will be in their 50s and 60s and will begin to retire. So not only do you have the aging population occurring, at the same time you have a large component of the nurses in the state now going to be retiring. The current age of an RN in the state of Oregon right now is 47 years of age. For an LPN, it's 49. For nurse practitioners, it's 49. For nurse anesthetists, it's already up to 51. And the studies are showing that the majority of nurses will leave the clinical setting by the time they're 55.
Would you address the percentages of gender and mix, and then also what is being done to recruit greater numbers of male nurses as well as female?
Chair Richardson, the current percentages in terms of genders of the nursing population, it's 89% female and about 11% male. Now, it used to be 98% were females and 2% were male, so that percentage is getting better. And one of the recruitment strategies is to increase the number of males entering into the nursing population and also the number of minorities entering into the population. As the wages for nurses have been increasing, I think we are seeing a larger number of males entering the profession.
What specifically is being done to recruit? Can you tell me? Do we have groups that are going into high schools and doing seminars on nursing as a vocation or as a profession? Or just asking, what are we doing in that regard? Because there's a lot of people coming out of high school that don't really know where to go. They just don't have a clue.
Chair Richardson, yes, there is a lot to be a lot of activity happening. Nurses are going into the high schools and trying to recruit people to be interested in the nursing profession. They are taking gifted high school students and putting them through what they call the Saturday Academy in Portland, and having them being mentored by nurses so that they have a role model for nurses. There has been a very active campaign by the Oregon Center for Nursing to go out there and recruit nurses in the high schools and in the community colleges for those people who don't know, for example, what they may want to do in terms of career. So they're actually the recruitment. There's been a lot of national recruitment. The Johnson & Johnson TV ads, I don't know if you've seen them on TV, are going national to try to recruit nurses. And in fact, what we have done, we've done a good job of getting people now interested in nursing again because the wages have gone up. But what's happening now is that they can't get into nursing schools.
The capacity to train. You have a waiting list.
Right. So now we have a large waiting list to get into all the Oregon nursing schools. And what the problem is that we don't have enough faculty to teach them. There's not enough clinical facilities. There's sometimes some of the nursing education programs even have a limited amount of classroom size. So we have to build the capacity of the nursing education programs in Oregon in order to now increase the number of people going into nursing in Oregon.
Would you address that? What's being done?
There are several things that are being done regarding that issue, Chair Richardson. Some is that the Oregon Health Sciences University and the University of Portland have both had accelerated programs for taking nurses with master's degrees and putting them through an accelerated course to become faculty members to teach. We have also built several simulation centers in the state to try to address the issue of lack of clinical space so that some of the clinical experiences of nursing students can be done in simulation centers. We're looking at distance learning. We're looking at trying to retain the older nurses in the workplace. I think that Rogue Valley Community College Rogue Valley Medical Center has a program for older nurses called Gray Matters, and it's using the older nurse who can no longer maybe do the heavy bedside nursing, but using them as mentors for the new nurses on the floor. We are also trying to expand career opportunities for nursing assistants and nurses and nursing nurse practitioners.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As it relates to the gender issue within nursing, could you address that within your own organization?
Chair Richardson and Representative Hannah, are you speaking about the staff at the Board of Nursing?
Yes.
That we are predominantly female also.
Were you asking? Maybe that's not the case. Maybe it's a good thing.
Chair Richardson, yes, it is the case. We are predominantly a female staff at the Board of Nursing. We do have, we don't have any male nurses on the staff.
You need a token.
But we do have a male investigator who does our criminal records checks. Our IT people are male, and our manager for licensing and certification is also a male. So, the male nurses can get paid more by practicing out there in the hospitals than they can by working for the Board of Nursing. So we don't have a lot of applicants, male applicants for our positions.
Representative Hannah.
My follow-up was, I guess, just to make the point that it's probably an area you ought to promote as well in terms of if you're out there trying to promote, some form of gender equity within your trade, that within your own organization you ought to do your very best to get that squared away as well.
Representative Richardson, Representative Hannah, I agree. We need to role model that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to have to leave in a little bit here, but I apologize, Mr. Chair. I've got, again, a med-mal problem to deal with. I'm completely in support of your budget, but I did have a couple of questions I wanted to just ask you to come back and give to us at a later time. One of the big issues facing the nursing profession is trying to get more put through, more people graduated, more people out into the field. I know that it takes about 2.5, almost 3 years to get someone through into an RN program through a community college. It takes a good 4 years to get them through a baccalaureate program. There's been a debate for years about which of those programs is the best. And I would tell you they serve different purposes. One, I think, produces a great deal of our instructors. But from the point of view of their ability to pass the national board and from their ability to work on the floor in a hospital, I think there's frankly little difference. And I've said that for a long time. What I'd like to know is the number of nurses that are coming out of the community colleges, the number that are coming out of the baccalaureate programs. We're in a crisis situation, and if I were to push one program or the other just for the numbers, I would tell you, if you can get someone through a program in 2.5 years versus someone through a 4-year program, I think you've got some value there. And I would, you know, I'm not saying cut the 4-year programs, I'm saying maintain the 4-year programs, increase the 2-year programs, and use those 4-year programs for your teachers, which you're going to need for the next 20 years, not just a short term. Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to have, Mr. Chair.
I need to go testify in another committee, so I'll be stepping out for a moment. I'd like to just add what you're saying is that maybe we need to look at a performance measure on numbers, because that where performance is measured, performance improves, and we'd like to have you be kind of a leader in helping to assure that that movement goes along.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly where I'm going. So what I'd like to have is an idea of the numbers being produced by the community colleges, the numbers being produced by the baccalaureate programs, and then a performance measure that can give us an idea of the quality of those two programs. There is no perfect answer to that question. One of the things I do look at is, you know, is how well they do as far as passing the exams on a national basis to get licensed. And that's a little bit variable between some of the community colleges. I'm aware of that also.
Mm-hmm.
But that is an area that we can look at and go to as a short-term goal, potentially. Where are we putting our resources to get the most production? And I would offer you have to think very hard about that question. Mm. I'm sure you have. And I know the push and pullness. I know the politics of it. Okay, but we're in a crisis, and we need to do what's most efficient.
And Senator Bates, I appreciate that. We do have that data, and on tab 7 of the presentation notebook, you will see how many people have graduated from the different nursing programs in the state and also the pass rates for each program. And we do have a performance measurement that talks about the pass rates of different programs, and when they don't meet a certain rate, 85% pass rate, we do then follow up with them. And we also have a performance measurement that states that we're trying to follow how much are we increasing the number of graduates from all programs throughout Oregon. And so that data hopefully is there, and we will continue to track it. In terms of new programs, we have had, as a result of the nursing shortage, several nursing programs come to the board for approval. And as long as they meet the standards in our administrative rules and regulations, we are approving those new programs. And
all of you, Chair. I read those numbers, okay, and understand them, I hope. What I don't see is a broad policy statement by the Board of Nursing that you want to go one direction or the other. I see you trying to satisfy all parties. Appreciate that. But I don't think you can in the situation. We have a limited amount of state funds, and we need to put those state funds where we'll do the very best job possible in producing nursing programs that will produce more people at a quality level. And since at this point I can't really say that I see the baccalaureate program producing a significantly higher quality, I have some concerns. In my own particular area, if you just took the bachelor program versus the 2-year program at Rogue Community College, and this is not necessarily statewide, and looked at how they did as far as passing the national boards, community college has consistently outproduced the program at Southern, which is under the auspices of OHSU. And so that is one example of where do we want to put our money in the Rogue Valley for nursing. Okay. That does not say we should cut either program, but if I were to build one program right now, not the expense of the other, but if I was going to build one program, I would build a program at Rogue Community College on the basis of these outputs. And I don't hear that, Mr. Chair, I don't hear that kind of a statement coming from the nursing board. All I hear is, we've got a crisis, we're getting older, we can't do it, we just cut OHSU, they're going to cut their nursing program. I'm not hearing what I need to hear. Okay?
Thank
you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate those comments, Senator Bates, and the board will discuss that issue.
Thank you.
I have a question for Senator Bates. Do we actually have a group in Oregon that's working combination between the board, the various teaching schools, the hospital industry, in terms of who is creating the strategies to deal with this? And who's responsible for creating the strategies?
Mr. Chair, I do not know if that's occurring. If it is, I'm not aware of it. That may well be having those discussions amongst the schools, and they probably are trying to collaborate on these very issues. But you get a lot of turf battles very, very quickly, I think. And, you know, OHSU is trying to do an overall program to maintain quality at with the local levels and his various campuses. I think they've done a good job doing that. We don't want to lose those programs. We need them for teaching and for I think, more intensive nursing sometimes. But I'm not sure that those programs in the past have cooperated as well as they should have. I think the last year or two, with the crisis on them, they're starting to do that more and more. But I'm not sure there is an overall overreaching, this is the plan we're going to go forward with. I think there's still a great deal of pushing and shoving involved in that. If there is, I'm not aware of it, but that might be my ignorance.
Your ignorance, Mr. Chair. We actually, I wish I had invited this committee. I didn't think about it when we had, we actually addressed the nursing shortage at our one of our policy committee meetings. And the Oregon Center of Nursing and the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, are two organizations that have really taken this task on. And the presentation that they presented to our committee, our health policy committee, was excellent. And there is a lot of activity in making, especially in the regards of training, so that your education, if you start in a community college one place, it's going to very easily everyone's going to have, except for a couple of community colleges, are having requirements for their education be standard statewide in order to get into all of the nursing programs. And I was just really quite impressed with the activities, including the question that Chair Richardson addressed regarding recruitment of men, and just that is increasing slowly but surely. But now that they're seeing that the pay is really becoming comparable, they're going into that field also.
Senator Wessel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This comment's a little dated now, but when we're talking about solutions and coming up with an answer, and this is a crisis, and I just don't want to say you guys have known it for a long time. Hell, we've all known it for a long time. But an answer will be found, and it's a heck of a lot better if it's found on that side of the dais than this side.
Mm-hmm. And members of the committee, I would like to refer you to tab 10 of the presentation document. We do have the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council strategic plan. And this is the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council is made up of the five major nursing organizations in the state. They have, in the last few years, come together to try to address the nursing shortage. And as you can see by this strategic plan, it shows the progress that they've made from 2001 through 2004. And then it goes on to tell you what the goals are and what they hope to accomplish in the next 2 years. So that does give you an overview of some of the activities that are happening in the state, and that there is a coordinated group that is looking at that from the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council with the Oregon Center for Nursing. And then, as Senator Amanda Sanderson talked about, there's also this Oregon Nursing Education Consortium, which is a model that is being looked at nationwide regarding cooperation between the baccalaureate program and the community college programs, where a nurse at a community college can go on and get the baccalaureate program and yet stay right there at the community college if she so wishes, or she can exit out after 2 years and become an associate degree nurse.
Thank you.
So I think that, you know, nursing is really trying to address the issues. They realize that they need to be up there and at the front to address these issues. So in general, the nursing shortage has impacted the services on the Board of Nursing. People are wanting more quicker response from the Board of Nursing and getting the people licensed and on the job. We're getting more issues regarding public policy questions for the Board of Nursing regarding what's happening out there in the work environment. And probably one of the major impacts from the Board of Nursing has been everybody wants to come to the Board of Nursing to get nurse manpower data, especially on the supply side, because we are the agency that has that information. additional factors that are affecting the services for the Board of Nursing is the Oregon's in-migration trends. We have had many nurses coming to Oregon from out of state, and that, of course, has increased the board's workload in the review of credentials and the issuing of licenses. The rapidly changing healthcare environment out there has increased the demand for all the board stakeholders regarding information and guidance, as I said. I think, as I also said, there are needs. The board has to help ensure that the educational structure for nurses is effective and appropriate and flexible and can accommodate to the healthcare practices and demands that are happening out there. So we have seen increased number of programs, both proprietary programs and state programs, come to the board for new approvals of nursing education programs. And also another factor affecting the services is due to the increased complexity of the disciplinary cases and the requirement that an investigatory report on each complaint be forwarded to the board within 120 days has increased the workload for our nursing practice investigation and compliance program. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, whatever you are. I have a question regarding the complaint process. And wanting to know, we heard from the Oregon Medical Association that they list everyone on a website, and you can go and you can find out, you know, who the person is and how many complaints have been made against them, and I'm not sure how much detail. But how open are the records? I know that you publish, I get the publication of those, but when a complaint is brought on someone, what process do you go through? What is the availability? If a complaint is brought against a nurse, do you notify the nurse right away of what the situation is? And can you just walk me through that?
Yes. Senator Ronis Anderson, the Board of Nursing also has a website where anyone can go 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to find out whether a nurse is currently licensed and whether that license has been encumbered or not. They can do it both by telephone or they can do it on the web. Under tab 9 of the presentation report, there is a flow chart that talks about the disciplinary process of the Board of Nursing, and we were going to go into that in more detail when we talk about our package number 2.
Thank you.
We were also asked to talk about the major agency changes in the past decade. So we have highlighted a few of them. First of all, a major change for us was in 1995 we implemented the law enforcement data check for every application, both new and renewal application that comes through the Board of Nursing office. And within a few years, the percent of applicants with arrest and convictions in the lead system had dropped from 6.2 down to 1.6. So we think that that's been a successful program. I think the word got out that the Board of Nursing does the criminal records check, and that has had a significant decrease. And so I think that shows that we a chance for the agency to be proactive in screening candidates that have criminal records checked prior to issuing them a license. The board also implemented a communications plan in 1999 with the addition of a public information officer and permanent funding for newsletters and publications that informs our licensees as well as the public. You will see in the back of the under tab 11 in the presentation book, you can see some of the publications that we give to nurses. I think we felt that it was important that we can't hold nurses to standards unless they know what the standards are. So we tried very hard to get that information out to the nurses. This has also been very important for us to be able to communicate to nurses as we have started e-government and our e-government renewals. It's been a very useful communication tool for us. In April of 2000, the Licensee 2000 database was implemented. Previous databases were one-dimensional, and they lacked functionality and flexibility. It gives us new security features. It enables us to do central sharing of information. And as I said, a lot of people are coming to us for workforce information, and this database has allowed us to provide the reports that these people are coming to the Board of Nursing and requesting. The Customer Service Center opened in May of 2002. This is going to be discussed in more detail in Policy Package 101, but the center has enabled us to provide customers with much better service and to improve us getting their answers answered in a much more expedient process. And also has allowed the people who were processing the applications and trying to answer the phones too to be able to focus on just processing the applications so that we are being able to also get the applications out the door or the licenses out the door quicker as people apply to the board. In 2004, the organizational chart of the agency took on a different appearance because we had the formulation of a consultant and policy group. This consultant and policy group has consultants for a nurse practice consultant, the certified nursing assistant consultant, the RNLPN scope of practice consultant, and the nursing education consultant. And as I said, we are getting more and more requests from nurses for guidance in these areas, and this nursing practice consultant group has allowed us to fulfill those requests and needs. One of the largest changes that has happened is within the last year, the e-commerce, and this we have gone online. We went live in June of 2004 to allow licensees to renew their license online. If a licensee can go online anywhere in the world and they can go online and fill out the questionnaires, and unless they have a criminal record or a positive LEDS check that we do on every licensee, their license could be renewed by the next morning at 10 a.m. More than 52% of the agency's revenues come from renewal of licensees, so this is a large program for us. And we are currently seeing about 30% of the licenses being renewed online. The other major change that has happened in the past decade is that we've had newly regulated populations that have been added to the Board of Nursing Authority. The certified nurse and ethicist came on board in 1998, and the clinical nurse specialist came on board in 2001. In terms of cost containment and improvements to program delivery, the board, as we told you last time, has really a regulated population of about 65,000 licensees, and the board's been able to take advantages of the economy of scale to implement many of these cost-saving efforts. And it's also used its funds to support long-term investment in technologies that can reduce the cost and improve program delivery. In addition, the high level of agency turnover due to retirements that happened in 2003 and 2004, we turned that into a positive by being able to restructure the departments and positions to more closely align with the new agency services and demands that are being placed in the on the agency. An example of this is that a complaint intake position was created by existing positions to centralize and standardize the way that citizens and employer complaints were received into the agency. Prior to this, complaints were taken by each investigator as the phone calls were received, and this resulted in inequitable workloads, and the investigators were unable to focus on ongoing investigation if they were trying to focus on that because they would keep getting interrupted with new telephone calls. So now we have centralized that into a single point of contact for complaints and follow-ups, and it's working very well. Another example of improvement to program delivery is that we converted one healthcare investigator position to a lower cost investigator 2 position to focus on the non-nursing types of investigations, and this is primarily the review and the resolution of criminal background checks. So we felt that a nurse did not need to be there to do those criminal background checks. So we have an investigator that does that, which then allows us to take the nurse investigators to specialize on the complex nursing practice investigations. Another example is that when e-commerce was implemented in June 2002, it enabled us to process applications in bulk, and it reduces the time spent by both the licensee and the agency staff on routine processes. So we were able to speed up our manual processes, and we were able to provide better customer service. In 1995, we did program improvement by establishing an interactive voice response system that I talked to you about. This is a telephonic service for licensees, verifications that they can go on and query, and licensees and employers can call it 24/7. This rerouted as many as 100 telephone calls a day from the operator that was having to answer all those calls. And in 2001, we invested in equipment that allows us to image documents both for historical storage and retrieval and data capture to our database for processing. This has allowed us to image paper documents that we currently have had to retrieve, and it saved us many hours of staff time to not have to go back and retrieve them because now they have it right on their desktop that they can access. Being co-located with 11 smaller healthcare licensing boards also enabled this agency to share resources with other agencies that we that these agencies might not have had access to without the Board of Nursing. We share physical resources with the other 11 healthcare licensing boards on our floor, like conference rooms, speakerphones, etc. We also, the Board of Nursing Network Administrator, administers the floor-wide email systems for the 11 other health-related boards on our floor. And he also acts as a technical liaison between those agencies and the Department of Administrative Services regarding technical issues. And then since January of 2000, the Board of Nursing also added a shared network support specialist with the other 11 health-related boards on the fourth floor of the Portland State Office Building. This position is supervised by the Board of Nursing but shared by all those other boards. So we feel that this is also an economy of scale by this cooperation between the different agencies. Our future plan for program improvements, fingerprinting. We have a legislative concept in for fingerprinting to give the board authority to fingerprint candidates for licensure. We feel that this will improve our program delivery because it will enable us to get specific information on criminal background checks, and we'll be able to make licensing decisions much more quickly and with more certainty. Mr. Chair.
Have you had much opposition to that concept at all?
Vice Chair Hansen and Senator Mona Sanderson. No, we have not had opposition.
Not from labor or any?
I think that the we talked to nurses about it around the state when we went and did a summer outreach tour. We talked to them about that we were going to do that concept. And the nurses at that time, I can give you... I was trying to see. Oh, we asked them if they were in favor of fingerprinting, and 83% of them said yes, that they were in favor of it. The opposition, I think, that I'm hearing from the fingerprint bill is coming from the ACLU. And there is concern from the long-term care industry that they don't have to do duplicate fingerprint checks for their employees, because right now they have to have fingerprint checks in order to work in long-term care facilities, and they're not against the Board of Nursing having the authority for fingerprinting, but they're wanting us to work with the Department of Seniors and People with Disability so that there won't be duplication of effort in terms of fingerprinting, and we're very willing to do that, and we're trying to work that out with them.
Okay, Senator Bates, and then Representative Hansen.
No,
well,
Westland.
It's close enough.
Excuse me. You're not Bates. This is Westland. Hey, Westland.
Let me check my driver.
Yeah. Maybe we're fingerprinting.
Yeah.
Well, focus back here.
Speaking of the...
Yeah, isn't it disconcerting? You got a big bill and you're concentrating on it and you rush right.
Done that too many times this session already. But what is the trial lawyer's argument or concern about fingerprinting? I mean, is it just
Senator Westland, I think they're most concerned. I mean, the question I remember them asking is, do you keep the fingerprints? I think it's a privacy issue, and they're real concerned about whether the Board of Nursing would keep the fingerprints once we ran the record. And we make it very clear we don't care about the fingerprints themselves, and we don't intend to keep them. What we care about is the report that we get from the fingerprints, but we don't care about the fingerprinting.
No, I was just trying to understand.
Yeah. I think it's
their argument.
It's I think it's a privacy issue.
Invasion of privacy.
Right.
Okay.
Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How will this be implemented? Will it occur just on the initial application that there be a fingerprint check, or at renewal, or how are you going to sequence it into
Chair Richardson and Representative Hansen? At this point in time, we are anticipating that we would just do it on the new applicants coming into the profession, people coming in from out of state and people entering the profession for the first time. Because of the number of licensees that we have, 61,000, mm-hmm. we thought we would start with the renewals, but we will still be doing the LEDS check on each renewal. So we'll do fingerprinting on the initial application, but we'll continue to do the state LEDS check on renewals. These are people who are already in the state.
Okay. Follow. What type of criminal histories disqualify someone from working in the profession? And I don't need to know all of them, but are there, is it?
Representative Richardson, Representative Hansen, they are mostly crimes against people. Abuse, murder, sexual abuse, theft.
Pardon?
Criminal mistreatment. They're the crimes against people that show a demonstrable relationship to the practice of nursing.
Okay, please continue.
Also, future plans. We hope to implement electronic applications for all our new licenses within the next 12 months. Right now, we are just doing it on renewal, but we hope to also do the electronic applications on all initial licenses. And one of the other future plans, and actually we are actually implementing it now, is to use increased video conferencing technology. We do have lots of task forces. We have a lot of rule hearings, and we're increasingly using the video conferencing that we have in order to get input from people throughout the state. And the nurses are really liking it. We are able to hook up to the different hospitals in the state, to the different nursing education programs, and they are really embracing this new technology because they feel that they can now be part of these task forces and part of these rule hearings and have input into it. So we are increasingly using that technology, and it's worked out very well for us. There are no other questions. I'll move on to the use of professional services and purchasing contracts. We were asked to address that. The board uses professional service contracts occasionally, but not frequently. Primarily, our contracts are made for under $5,000, and we use them mostly to obtain expertise that's not available in the existing staff or to supplement existing staff when manpower is not available. Examples of this are using contracts for expert witnesses, sometimes for college nursing education surveys, or sometimes for management of a board task force that needs specific expertise. Most of the agency's purchasing is done through the state negotiated umbrella contract. One large exception is the nursing assistant testing contract that we have. In 1999, the board switched from an internally managed program because we could not support all the federal requirements for the nursing assistant testing contract. And we contracted with a testing service that meets all the federal requirements as well as our state sets requirements for services to the testing candidates. This is our largest single services and supply budget item. It's almost $900,000 per biennium is spent on this contract. And the contract RFP that we developed for this is developed by agency staff in coordination with the DAS procurement department.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Mona Sanderson.
How many nursing assistants? You probably have it somewhere in our information. Are tested per biennium? I was just wondering what kind of bang for the buck we got.
Chair Richardson, Senator Mona Sanderson, we test about 300 nursing assistants per month.
Per month. Okay.
Right. And I'm sure we have that in, under one of our tabs.
3,600 a year.
Tab 6.
Tab 6.
And Mr. Gorse tells me 7,200 per biennium. 7,200 per biennium.
7,000 per biennium.
2,600 a year. 2,600 a year.
7,000 per biennium that we test?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The issue, Senator Miles Sanderson, the issue with the nursing assistants is they turn over very quickly. They don't stay in the workforce very long, so we are continually testing nursing assistants. But then they test and they become certified, but they don't stay as nursing assistants very long. So there's a constant turnover of nursing assistants.
Just follow, so it's about a, what is the fee to take a nursing assistant test? I mean, if I just do the numbers real grossly, it's $130 per nursing assistant. If you divide 7,000 into 900,000.
All right. Senator Monsanto, the current fee is $106.
Okay.
To take the exam for a nursing assistant. And many of the nursing assistants have that paid for by the nursing facility.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Budgetary issues that are unique to the Oregon State Board of Nursing. First, the Board of Nursing is increasingly finding itself as a source of information. As I mentioned, we are constantly being asked for nursing workforce data and also guidance on nursing practice issues. This demand for information from all the stakeholders is changing the structure of the agency, and this has affected the staffing of the agency as well as the workload of individual employees. The Certified Nursing Assistant Program is unique among licensing boards. It's a federal program. It's required as a result of OBRA 87. And the board receives funds from Medicaid and Medicare through the Department of, with a contract through the Department of Human Services, Senior and People with Disabilities. Another unique budgeting issue for the Board of Nursing is that fees were changed at the beginning of the 2003-05 biennium after discussion during the 2003 legislative session. And currently we have House Bill 5053, which is the fee ratification bill, to be discussed in this subcommittee. The following fees were changed as of a result of the discussion that took place in the last legislative session. These fees had not been increased since 1999 before we implemented them in October 1st of 2003.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Miles Sanderson.
Do those fees actually pay full costs? Are they sustainable? I mean, you are a little short. If the numbers are right for the nursing assistant, the certified nursing assistant, it should be 130 if it costs you 900,000. And how do you compensate?
Senator Mona Sanderson, I'm Pat Miles, the business manager. The difference with the CNA side is that we get matching funds. We get a dollar for dollar, which we'll be talking about a little bit later, but certainly is pertinent to this. RN and LPN fees, advanced practice fees, and medication aid fees are intended to cover the costs for that licensee group. But CNA fees are generally calculated within the whole population to cover about 50% of the costs of that population group.
Thank you.
Is there going to be any recommendation for a fee increase in the next 2 years? Or is there going to be any change in your fee structure in the next 2 years?
Representative Richardson, we have no plans for that at this time.
Is it my understanding that you could do that if you chose to, that the legislature has given you the authority to raise those and that we merely need to ratify it in the following session?
Yeah. Representative Richardson, it's always been our policy to have open communication with you, and we will we always, if it's an existing fee that we choose to increase, to talk about it in the budget session prior to any implementation of those fees. So every time we've increased a fee, we talk about it twice, first before we do it, and then second when we ratify it with you like we are here today. The fees as they are proposed to be ratified should easily carry us through the coming biennium. And we would evaluate then if we should hopefully always provide something new for that additional cost.
Just want to make sure that if we represent that these have been in place for the last couple of years, we're ratifying them, that we can also say, and there will be no fee increase for next biennium. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
There was one fee was established due to the implementation of new rules. That was the CNA 2 registration fee. It was a one-time fee of $5, and it was paid by the training programs to register a nursing assistant who has taken a board-approved training program in a special area. And we established the CNA 2 role as a result and as a response to the request from the long-term care industry to have an additional level of a CNA who could do additional tasks. And they were hoping that it would be a retention tool for certified nursing assistants as kind of a career advancement for nursing assistants. And the board agreed that if we could help in any way to retain certified nursing assistants in the workforce, that we wanted to do that. So we've worked very hard during the last biennium to establish this new CNA 2 role. And as a result of that, we established this $5 one-time fee for the certification of a CNA 2. Only one fee is being proposed with this budget, and that is if we do get fingerprinting authority granted through House Bill 2102, then we propose a fingerprinting fee of $53 to cover that fingerprinting cost. We are going to be talking about this in Policy Package 103, and this fee would be based on the cost to us of processing the fingerprinting cards through the Oregon State Police.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss Anderson.
When a nurse becomes inactive, do they just notify the board, and is there a payment to become inactive, and then do they, because I see your reactivation fee, and is that for those who are inactive for a period of time?
Senator Moss Anderson. Normally, when a nurse decides not to renew, they simply let their license expire, and that's the end of it. There is no fee. If they decide to come back to work in Oregon, of course, they have to reactivate their license. I think it was two bienniums ago that we got authority to create a retired nurse license status, and that cost $20. It doesn't matter how many licenses the nurse had. If she was an LP and an RN and then a nurse practitioner, she pays a one-time $20 fee. We change all of her statuses to retired. She has then the authority to use the title nurse retired. And she sent a license card. Looks slightly different, of course, but they have that option, and we do not restrict the age or the amount of time that nurses practiced in Oregon to get that.
What benefit is it?
Representative Richardson, it's amazing how many nurses identify themselves very personally with their career. And there were nurses that were, we do actually have active nurses who are 85 years old, but there are nurses who continued to, they were in emotional angst when they had to give up their license because they no longer met the requirements to renew, which are basically about 6 months of work within a five-year period. So these nurses who retire very much identify as being nurses, and this gives them the acknowledgement that they need, if you will. It also is our opportunity to instruct them that they can't practice. They can use a title, but they can't practice.
Newsletters.
And did they still get newsletters?
We'll have to check on this, but we also think that they get the newsletters and the communications from the Board of Nursing. I guess we're not sure about that, so we need to check on that.
Thank you.
We have two issues in our essential packages that are unique to our agency, or at least merit some note.
First of all, essential package 021, this is meant for phase-ins. The main point here is we've included the cost of merchant fees for accepting credit cards. In 2003, they changed the accounting rules. Prior to that, we could reduce our revenues by the cost of the merchant fees. Now we have to charge that as an expense. So we have $2,400 in our budget currently, which covers basically what we receive from walk-in visitors. This doesn't cover our electronic commerce, which is growing dramatically. In the first 6 months of e-commerce, we only had about a 26% participation rate for that period of time, but we paid over $4,000 in merchant fees. The $67,362 that we're requesting as an increase is based on two assumptions. One of those is that we will be implementing new applications, that is initial licensor in Oregon, applications on the web within the first year of the biennium. And second, that 50% of the revenues that we receive through fees will be received through e-commerce. And we don't think that's too excessive since we've had such immediate response so far. The other essential package of note is 022. What's happening there of note is that we have our three positions in the customer service center, which were given to us as limited durations. That was 2.5 FTE, and they are going away in this package. So we're reducing our force there, if you will.
Would you mind explaining the conflict between the two?
The reducing? I'm sorry, I don't understand.
The prior package indicates that you're preparing for the substantial increase in relicensing that will take place over the Internet. Your customer service center, my understanding is that you have three permanent presently and three temporary positions that were given by the last session, that the six people work that deal with walk-ins of between 35 and 85 a day, an average of 5,000 phone calls a month, which is 238 a day on a 21-day month, work month, you know, five-day week, and licensing or renewal applications of 2,275 per month. My assumption is that the reason you weren't given three full-time permanent FTEs last time was because the prior committee probably thought that maybe this would be worked through and would not be necessary for them to be permanent. You have 2,275 people in the past who have done it through the mail and so forth. Now the majority of them, or a large number of them, will be doing it through the Internet, which will drastically lessen the amount of time spent on this relicensing. And so why should this committee give you permanent FTEs?
Well, Representative Richardson, why don't I just skip to Package 101 and talk about that. In Package 101, we have two elements, and so the first one I'd like to talk about is those permanent positions. Let me catch up with my...
Can you identify where we are now?
Yeah, where
are I'm sorry. We're now at our policy package discussion on page 14 of our testimony.
I'm in page 71 of the Orbit's budget narrative.
So there's two places you can find this information. If you want to follow along with Pat, she's on page 14, and the chair is in the budget document on page 70.
Package 101. We established the call center in May of 2002 to provide more efficient and effective customer service. We didn't go into a lot of detail with this presentation. We've talked about it many times. But basically, what we had was we had individual specialists. Each technician handled one licensee type and one type of application. For example, nurse examinations or nurse endorsements. These are people moving to Oregon, or CNA testing or whatever. And when someone called in to our office, that was the only person they could talk to. Not very efficient for anyone. Yeah. So we established the call center, and it only came into being the 1st of May 2002. So we had
certain objectives, and we think we're meeting those. First of all, we didn't want application processing to be impacted by an increase in call volume, which it was when we had the same person going. So we would get a consistent speed of processing. Second, we wouldn't have the converse. We wouldn't have customer service being impacted by fluctuations in application volume. We wanted timely and consistent response to those calls that we did receive, and we wanted people to be served in the order in which they called in. You shouldn't get different service just because the person that you can only talk to is out on lunch. We wanted someone there all the time to respond to people.
By the way, that makes tremendous sense. Every business that is efficient has that kind of crossover. You don't have silos within a business because somebody's twiddling their thumbs, somebody else is busy, and they say, sorry, it's not my job. So, I mean, we're with you.
Absolutely. The other concept here is the applications that didn't need quite as much attention, like e-commerce, automated processes, could be handled in a production environment, while those requiring a higher level of attention, and we do get those, advanced practice apps need careful scrutiny, several other types, they're going to get special attention without a lot of interruptions for phone calls. As I said, I think we're meeting those goals. So in 2003, during the legislative session, we requested 3 permanent positions. At that time, we'd been live for less than 10 months. We didn't have a lot of data. We asked for the 3 permanent positions, 2.5 FTE, to complete the staffing of the service center because we had to hire temps in order to meet our call volume. So we were given, as we've been talking about, the limitation and the authority to hire temporaries, and that converted in a real world into these limited duration positions. So we're asking that the positions become permanent. This is actually an exhibit we used a couple years ago, but it still holds true today.
Where can we find this in our packet?
It is actually just on our slide page. I'm sorry. Our slides are on tab 2. Page 18 of tab 2.
In the presentation notebook.
Okay, it's useless.
It's hard to see.
It's a little bit weird to look at to start with, but let me explain why it's important to us. The top line that's going up and down, when it goes down, that means we don't have full staffing. We don't have all the bodies who are supposed to be there. And the line below is how many calls don't get answered. So it's really very dramatic. It's not like it's seasonal or anything. When 2 people are out of the office, you know, 50% of the calls don't get answered. It's that kind of a relationship. We talked 2 weeks ago about people's...
Just a moment. When you say when 2 people, are you saying when 2 people are out of the office when you only have 3 people? I mean, are you disallowing the other 3 people that you've had for the last 2 years?
That's a very good point, Representative Richardson. What we have is we have a lot of binary switches. We have 6 people, but one person sits at that front desk because we have a tremendous number of walk-ins. She can't be answering telephone calls and serving those people. When she goes on break or goes to lunch, someone has to move into that position.
Okay, now, I want to challenge you on that immediately because very few business offices have somebody sitting there filing their nails and reading novels when somebody's not walking in. In other words, you have dual responsibilities where they do answer phones unless somebody is there, and then the phone will be answered by a secondary person. It, you know, kind of rolls over, but they are the primary receptionist because people don't come in all day long, you know, especially when you have only 35 to 85 a day, depending on how long each one's there. So I'm just saying that if that is your present situation, that the person at the front desk only greets people when they come in, then you may be losing out on 2 hours a day of answering.
Representative Richardson, I think using the term reception probably is a little bit
antiquated.
It's not quite adequate. She does greet people, don't get me wrong. And she, in some cases, is simply greeting them and calling someone from the back to come talk to that person. But she also is, most of those walk-in people we get are licensees who are either applying for a new application or renewing, they come in and they have questions. She is actually providing service with those individuals when she's there. Also, we have a kiosk for e-commerce in our reception area, and many of the people who come in and decide to do this electronically because their license is expiring tomorrow, she's in the position of needing to help and assist them. So it's a much more active role than what might be implied through the title. She does answer the phones. Don't get me wrong there either. She does answer the phones if things are quiet as far as the reception area, but we don't actually count on that because usually if it's busy season, that's when she's going to be busy as well. We also have one of the people who actually sits in the call center is the renewal clerk, and that is a full-time job. Again, she can get on the phones if things get really crazy, but if she's not there or if she's answering phones, then renewals are not being processed. It's one or the other. We have actually three people who would be classified as call center phone answering operators. And 1.5 FTE is there. So with three people answering phone calls, if one person's out sick, you have then two people whose primary job is to answer calls. And they also send out applications and do other types of work like address changes and clerical work that they fill in when the phones aren't ringing. And then the other folks do the scanning of applications and production center work and aren't necessarily phone operators. So that's part of the problem because there are other jobs. It would come back to the same problem we had before. Well, you can process applications or you can answer the phones. And, of course, when just on a day-to-day basis, if everyone's there, they still have to take lunch breaks. They still have to take regular breaks. And it's very easy to get down to one person answering the phones if we're not fully staffed. And that's how we lose calls, basically. The performance measures, we had three performance measures that are very much impacted by the call center. And the first one we talked about 2 weeks ago, already in depth. In fiscal year 2001, before we had a call center, our customer satisfaction surveys, we had good marks, but they weren't as great as we'd like them to be. Our accuracy of information was at 93%. Courtesy of staff was 86%, stressed people. And ease of access to staff was only at 80%. At that time, they had to use an automated attendant, and it took them through a menu. And you'd be amazed how many calls I got being the business manager for someone who wanted an RN license. Misdirection happened because people, you know, just wanted a body. Give me something. With the call center, they call in and they immediately get a voice that says, you know, who you've reached, and the first available operator will get to you. Our accuracy of information is actually improved by a couple points. That's always hard when you're in the 90 percentile to 95%. Our courtesy of staff went up from that 86% to 96%. They have someone who's been trained. We do send our staff to specific customer service training. And then finally, ease of access to staff went from 80% to 92%. At the very least, when they call into the call center, if they can't help you, they can tell you who can, and they will tell you if that person's out or what the, you know, what's going on. We use an electronic in-out board. They can tell, I'm in Salem today. If they transfer a call there, the caller understands. They won't hear from me for a while. And they set realistic expectations. Another performance measure that's important is obviously the analysis of dropped calls. We talked about it here, but there's a direct correlation between bodies answering phones and the daily abandoned call rate. And finally, the renewal processing timelines are impacted by the customer service center staffing because that position actually is one of the positions we're asking for here. If that person isn't there that day, or if
someone else isn't there that day, that renewal person is constantly on and off the phones helping out with the call volume. We actually have the renewal person there in the call center because she does work on the phone so very much. Before I move on to the second element, were there questions about the positions? I don't want to...
Well, not necessarily questions, except that as a business fan, looking at the work that's being done, I would not hire six people to do that work in a private sector company. Looking at what the nurses are paying for their fees and so forth, I'm looking at the pay rate is somewhere around $2,199 a month. I think that's roughly $2,200. If we add 35% for PERS and other benefits, which may be a little bit low, but it's roughly right, that brings it over $2,900 a month. If you do that over the biennium, that's $71,000. Is that biennium or is that? Yeah, that'd be biennium. And so I'm not inclined to recommend to the committee that we make these permanent, because with the internet registrations coming, I think that you're going to find that you're going to become more efficient than you even expect to be at this point, and that you may be able to get by on with five people doing that level of work that's being done there. And if somebody occasionally doesn't get a call, we'll understand an immediate answer. These are not a 911 call center. These are renewals, which are not as crucial that a renewal get handled the same day it comes in, as maybe it might even have to wait to the next day. I mean, you have some control over that, and you have some control over calling back somebody who has a renewal question, since it's not an emergency thing. I just think that in the long term, it might be beneficial for the nurses to possibly, in the next biennium, find that $71,000, which would be more than, could be saved, because you'll find that you might be able to get by without six people in that position. Nevertheless, I'm not going to recommend that we cut back the temporary positions at this time. I only am going to be recommending that we not approve them for permanent FTE positions. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to sound like point and counterpoint, but it may come up and come out that way. The legislature, and this becomes a standard running discussion that probably can affect 90% of the budgets that we deal with. The legislature always has the power to take a full-time FTE and move it back to being a limited duration position. We always have the authority every 2 years not to fund a position. So when we make something permanent, it's really a question of semantics, I think, more than anything else. We're saying, yeah, there's a need for this position that's probably ongoing. But certainly if calls dropped off or a lot of things, you've got the flexibility, and I assume the wisdom to come in and readjust your staffing patterns. The other thing would be, if you allocate out this one or two of these positions over the whole cost of licensing, my guess is, and I'm not a nurse, but my guess is I would rather pay a couple bucks more on my license and have a much higher opportunity to have my telephone calls when I need them answered, and answered by a live person. As a patient, occasionally, I think I would rather have my nurse getting her phone call answered by a live body the first time she calls, rather than maybe having to call a couple times and then maybe not have an opportunity to warm the instruments up or whatever, because she's been on the phone, that my personal comfort might be impacted by that in some manner or another, and that just terrifies me. Anyway, so that I would really favor following the direction of having them become permanent, if they've been in the budget for 2 years, the same need, the same standards is there. I think that's that's when we would make them permanent, and certainly then review them as we should be doing every 2 years in terms of whether that status should change.
Other comments? Please continue.
Part two of Package 101 is a rent increase request. When the Department of Administrative Services and the board began planning for the office reconfiguration project that was approved for the 2003-05 budget, it became evident that the existing office space wasn't sufficient to house the functions and people necessary to carry out the board's mission. There really was no place to put people. So some people share cubicles, and we have investigations that wait for an available room to have an interview in. Based on several factors, including the needs of several other agencies for facilities, DAS approved a plan to increase floor space for the Board of Nursing. The new floor space, the plan, meets DAS's space use standards. They have very strict guidelines there, and allows for enough common use areas to schedule interviews and meetings when we need to. The amount in this package is $140,084. This equates to about 3,000 additional square feet of agency-occupied space. It will add two more interview rooms to conduct investigations in dedicated to those interviews, and allows for a dedicated computer room for our equipment, and adds enough cubicles to house the positions that we have.
Senator Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know off the top of your head what your parent paying per square foot?
Senator Westland, the 2005-07 published rate is $1.40 a square foot. The math thing comes out a little odd because in the Portland State Office Building, for our rent bill, we're 75% of the space is what we occupy, and about 25%, give or take, is building and floor common space that we're paying for. So that's a rough on it.
Mr. Chair, the basic math is when you say we're dealing with biennial numbers. When you say 3,000 square feet, that's based over the biennium. I mean, we just take the number, we divide it by $1.40, and we're coming out with 10,000 square feet.
Bear with me, please, sir. I have the actual computation here.
Was it 3,000 additional feet on top of some existing base?
The $140 is the total cost, not an additional cost, right?
The $140,000 is the additional cost for us of rent.
All right, the addition.
There's the computation is about 3,040 assigned space square footage, 672 feet in floor common, and 457 feet in building common. So that actually gives us 4,169 square feet that we'll be paying for in order to occupy the 3,000 square feet. And then that's times 24 months, of course, and that's where we get the... So monthly, the cost will increase to $5,837 a month times the 24 months.
$5,837. If you were in the private sector and you were looking at the money that you were going to be paying yourself, you might not say 3,000 additional occupied space, because you'd be dealing with real space. That's like saying we don't occupy the bathrooms, and so we're not going to include it even though we pay for it, which probably is what is also mm-hmm. included in these other spaces. So we have 4,100 square feet additional space for 140,000. Senator Westland, excuse me.
That's right.
Well, Mr. Kerr's question, and I don't know very much about real estate development, but that seems like an awfully high ratio to me, you know, functionally 25% of the space, common, lobby. Does anyone have a sense of that? Not that, I mean, it could just be, hey, here's a spot and it's more convenient. Legitimately more convenient. That just seems like a high ratio.
It would depend on the layout of the place. You know, if you're going to rent a building, and it depends on your who your landlord is and how he deals with that, because they might do elevators and stairways and everything else that you don't even use. It depends on how they negotiate it. And if you're doing it yourself, you're certainly going to be concerned about that, because it all comes from your bottom line dollar amount. Here we have DAS doing it. It's $1.40 basic rate per square foot for everyone. And you have a limited number of people. What is your current footage, occupied footage?
Our occupied footage is a little over 8,000 square feet right now.
Or the number of employees that occupy the 8,000 square feet?
Currently, we have 42 positions, including those limited duration positions. And mainly our difference there is that we have so few interview rooms that it's a lot of the common areas, that it's not just the cubicles,
right,
it's the common areas. What's happened is we built several interview rooms, and they've had to be used for offices and stuff, because that's where the bodies got put. We looked around and said, there's a place. So when we got the current square footage, we had about, I think it's in one of these, so if I misspeak, I'm sorry, but we had significantly fewer. I'm thinking much fewer than 35 positions when we occupied the space.
That doesn't relate to anything, because we have no way of knowing if you had too much space or too little, or when you bought that original space, if it was with the anticipation that you're going to have 60 employees. See, so what was then doesn't relate to what is now. Mm-hmm. How many, and we're not here to micromanage, but we're here to ask the hard questions, because these are hard dollars. It's not even our money directly, but it's set up so that the legislature will watch out for the nurses and help make sure that there's accountability. And we know that you're trying to do a good job, but nevertheless, we want to make sure that there is a measurement and these questions are asked. This is even an in-house deal. This is the government's own space. Do you have a comment?
If I may, Mr. Chair, once again, Jim Gores, Budget Management. This is kind of what you're hearing from the Board of Nursing. DAS regulates, and they set the prices, they set the policies, and they also set, it's a flexible, but it's fairly firm guideline as to how many square foot per personnel there is. And according to DAS's figures, Board of Nursing is at the is basically overextended for staff versus square footage. And so they presented their case to DAS, and DAS said, yes, you are way overcrowded for what we want, and yes, you do need this additional space. One of my smaller boards actually had an OSHA violation, because that's the other thing you bump up against with this, is you can come into OSHA violations if you are too tightly packed.
Understand. How many of these 42 staff members are in cubicles? Roughly.
I'm doing a head count in my mind. I think almost all but four.
Really?
We have very few.
What is the rated area for a cubicle? Is it 100 square feet? 10 by 10?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I'd defer that to somebody with facilities background.
Representative Richardson, we can get that information for you, because there are standards from DAS, but I can't.
I understand. If you just take your 8,000 square feet divided by the 42, it's 190 square feet per employee,
right,
which is a 10 by 19.
Right.
And so if you take away half of that, because you're going to be doing conference rooms and other things pretty soon, there's a lot of extra space. So I just find that interesting.
Representative Richardson, there actually were a lot of computations that go into this. They have a standard size for clerical staff. They have a standard size for management staff. They even have sizes for offices if you're at the right level. That you have different sizes for how many people you want to put in interview rooms. We have asked for a 50 square foot area for an interview room, because we have to fit five people in there sometimes.
50 square
I'm not sure. That's not right. I'm sorry. That would be 500.
Okay.
Yeah, we all do that one.
It's a closet.
He didn't even count the inside wall, man.
That's right. We're just, Yeah. So part of it was getting more of those smaller interview rooms that added up. Then every time you add cubicles, you have to have a percentage for proper width of aisles and everything. That's eaten up a lot of space there. So and then complicating everything is that you can't just take 10 extra feet if the space available is 20. Either take 20 or zero. That kind of illustration. So we're dealing with
for the offices. Of course, if you're dealing with cubicles, then you have a lot more flexibility since you have light and HVAC over the top. I'm with you. I understand that.
And Representative Richardson, we also have a conference room that's figured into our square footage, too, that we use for staff meetings and task force meetings, and we share it with other of the smaller agencies on the floor as
well. You presently have the conference room, though?
We do have a conference room, it will hold, it's coated with extra doors and everything to hold 70 people. It's 60, excuse me. It's approximately this size, but it's an odd shape. If you wished, we could bring a draft floor plan if that would help to understand the overall concept of what's going on.
The goal is not to micromanage on this. You know, we have two government agencies. This is $140,000 that DAS is going to be receiving from the nurses. I'm sure that you aren't interested in expanding a domain at the expense of those that you serve. I mean, I have no indication that that's the case. Ms. Manthe has been to your facility and verifies that you are tight on space. It's just a lot of money for a large expansion all at once, and it's 4,000 square feet. And from a private enterprise standpoint, if you're going to expand 4,000 square feet at this kind of an overhead, you're going to seriously be looking at what you're getting for it, because it comes out of the bottom line. It's real money. I'm inclined to, on this issue, after we've vetted it, to just allow you to go ahead with it, because you're the ones that have to live with it, and you've assured us that you're going to do it within the money that you're presently receiving. But it's going to be, you know, considered if you come in 2 years from now and say we don't have enough money to get by, because we say, well, that's because you're spending too much on overhead. You really didn't need 4,000 square feet. But we'll see where that goes. Representative Hanna, and then Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the thing that concerns me, and because you're both at the table, maybe you can look each other in the eye and have this discussion, but when you think that 39% of the new square footage that you're getting, you're paying for common area, and in the commercial building trades and in the shared medical office space, joint venture style buildings, somewhere around 7-12% of space would be shared as the entry area to a building, common restroom area, those types of things, and yet you're getting dinged for just under 40% of that. You might want to talk to your landlord. I don't think that I would want to sit in your chair and go back to the folks that I'm representing and say I'm signing up for a 37% increase in rent, and just under 40% of that is space that we don't even get. I think you'd want to have that conversation. I know that this committee has had, you know, lengthy discussions about it. It's, you got to manage your own business, but just from an outsider's view, that seems to be an exorbitant amount paid for common area.
Also, for truth in presentations, I would have appreciated had this said, we will be renting 4,140 feet, of which 3,000 is occupied space. Because as soon as I start seeing something that looks like it's kind of balancing the presentation, giving only a partial, you know, revelation of what's going on, it makes me real suspicious. And so I'm all in favor of open, transparent presentation. Yes.
If I may, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, once again, Jim Gores, Budget Management. Just to address that, just to give you some background,
As a landlord, we'd like you. We represent a landlord. How can you do this for these poor folks?
For the landlord. However, I will speak for as a budget analyst and inform you as to what that discrepancy is. The charge you see there for building common is there is an old daycare at the base in the first level of the Portland State Office Building that has been vacant for a while. I don't know how long. Therefore, all tenants in that building pay for a portion of that space. And so that is the discrepancy you see there.
Is it currently a daycare center?
No, it is currently vacant.
Why would tenants agree to be paying part of something that is of no value to them?
I cannot answer that, sir.
Maybe you'd like to respond to that. You know,
if I may, just trying to keep it very brief, I promise. Pretty much the entire first floor of the Portland State Office Building is building common. We have a huge cafeteria, and the daycare center was originally subsidized basically by all the tenants paying for the floor space. As that gets occupied, then hopefully our building common areas will go down. And DAS is trying to address the large cafeteria, and we have some very, very large meeting rooms in the building as well that we're all paying for and utilizing. Yes, we do use the first floor rooms, as do all the tenants in the building. DAS is trying to get better utilization of the space by actually they're going to build some additional conference rooms in the cafeteria space because it's underutilized. But basically the entire footprint.
Conference rooms that you could use?
Yes, that all building tenants would be able to use.
Great, so you may not need these extra conference rooms.
Unfortunately, there is a lot of competition for that, but we will be obviously looking at opportunities there.
Okay, we can move on. I would suggest that the tenants in that building might want to put together a tenant association to unify against their landlord, because it sounds like you guys are getting hammered, and this is coming out of your budgets, and that's money that could be used elsewhere. Right. Representative.
Two real quick comments. One of the things that may be helping to drive that, too, is as you get into taller Portland Class A office buildings, which that is, you've got the elevator needs become a lot bigger than if you're dealing with a two- or three-story building. You've got more banks of elevators and more spaces taken up, both with the elevators and the space in front of them, and that goes all the way up on each floor. The other thing, and I'm just wondering in terms of all the mechanisms of cubicle space and space per cubicle and all of that, does DAS differentiate between whether you have a large worker or a small worker?
You get oversized cubicles for oversized folks?
Or if you... I'm being facetious.
Sounds like an ADA issue.
Representative Hansen, they do differentiate workload, though. If we can make a case that an employee has a larger need for filing space by the nature of their job, they do give us that space. But we had to lay that all out for them ahead of time. They are willing to depart from standards for exceptional situations.
Okay. All right. We need to make sure there's time to go into the investigative package.
And Representative Richardson, Kim Cobrain, who is the program executive for the Investigations and Compliance Department of the Board of Nursing, is going to present package 102.
Thank you, Joan.
Welcome, Ms. Cobrain.
Thank you. I'm starting here on your presentation packet. The written testimony begins on page 16. And if you also have the governor's recommended budget, the information there starts on page...
We're in a different book.
Yeah,
77. That's
okay, page 77 is the orbits portion of it.
Two. But this, my remarks will mostly be coming from the presentation packet on starting on page 16.
Which...
With 16 and 12.
I'm sorry, of the presence. You know, I said this would be helpful, and I think I'm being less than helpful.
No,
oh, okay.
No, you're fine.
We search for information.
Well, have we come to the right place then? I'm here to talk about, as Jen said, Policy Package 102, which essentially seeks two and a quarter FTE to increase our investigative staff. Two of the positions would be for investigator healthcare advisors, and one would be the 0.25 would increase the complaint intake person that we have now, that position up to a full-time position. It's currently only a three-quarter position. So that's the we're talking about three positions, although one of them is just it already exists, if you will, and it's just to make it a full-time position. Historically, the board has tracked data manually, and as I should actually note, on page 16 in the third paragraph down, the paragraph begins in fiscal year 2004. That is a typo. That should read in fiscal year 2000.
I don't find that at all.
They were page
16 of.
It's this book.
Oh, the very front. Under tab one.
Yes.
Okay, that's why.
The board implemented a database in 2000, and we were able to start inputting data, learning the database, and we now have a database that is mature enough to help us get a handle on what kind of caseloads we really have. We've used that to help understand what our workloads are and to hopefully start marrying, if you will, the skills that we need with the kind of work that we have. We've taken some steps to that already, including the creation of the complaint intake resource coordinator. That's the one we want to increase to full-time. And we have altered a health advisor nursing investigator position into a straight investigator two position to deal with criminal backgrounds. Again, we were looking at that and realizing that we have enough cases there to support just someone who's got investigative skills without necessarily the nursing knowledge overlay. Having done all of this, though, within the resources that we had, we're still falling behind. And I never wanted to start at the beginning of, well, let's just throw more bodies at something. I don't personally think that's a good approach. I like to understand why staff is being added. But having worked through the math, if you will, and looked at the caseloads, it is time to add in my humble opinion, some more investigators with a nursing background. If I can turn your attention to page 17 of the information, what we were able to do now with the database is break down the kinds of cases we have, and we broke them down to three different areas. One is a background investigation. This is something that is conducted on every applicant, either initial or renewal, if there is a positive criminal history or if they have answered yes, I have some sort of mental health impairment or substance abuse issue that would affect my ability to practice. Well, not surprisingly, we investigate that. We do approximately 1,400 of those per year. If they take on an average of 4 hours to complete, again, these aren't really significant cases. That's looking at a workforce need of 5,600 hours. The larger time piece is the what I am referring to as the conduct complaints. We get approximately 700 a year. That's an average. This year we were slightly over that. Last year we were under that. Again, these are much more complicated cases. And as we give an average of 23 hours, we're looking at over 16,000 hours needed. With eight investigative staff, that maxes us out right there. But we have more than that. We have other investigations that we do. These are minor issues that nonetheless take up our time. The standard rule I give my investigators, if it's an issue that can be resolved in less than 2 hours, put it in this area. It still goes to the board for ratification and action, but we do not turn it into a case. Turning it into a case and entering it into the database takes time, it takes resources, it takes staff power. We have decided to conserve that staff power by having these types of cases go to the board in a much more truncated fashion. We still keep track of them, but we don't track them at this point in L2K, our license database, although, frankly, that's something I'm hoping we can do in the future to improve that database. That you take those types of cases added to the other two type, and we come out with needing over 22,000 hours per year of investigative work. We don't have near that, which explains, if you recall back to the performance measures that we talked about when we were last here, if you might... I will use the word abysmal meeting of some of the performance marks. We weren't meeting them. I think we have a better understanding of why we weren't meeting them. We clearly have a better understanding of what our cases are like, which brings us here to you today to say we would request more staff to help address this.
Again, Mr. Chair, to address the question. Yeah, address my question I had earlier.
Mm-hmm.
When a complaint is brought against a nurse, how do you relay that information to her?
To the nurse? Chair Richardson, Senator Moniz Anderson, we get, as I said, a number of complaints that come in, and we are very cognizant that a complaint coming in the door is an allegation. It's not proof. And we, our typical process is to gather documents, talk to witnesses, talk to the complainant to see if there is any substance to this allegation. If there is, in addition to gathering documents and talking to witnesses, we will contact the licensee and have them come in and speak to us. They are, if you will, the most critical witness because we want to hear from their perspective what has happened. Before this, it's not a hearing. It is just an investigative interview.
Is she notified right away if an allegation has been made?
Senator Moniz Anderson, no. She is not, or he is not. That is for two reasons. One is we will discard frivolous or complaints that are clearly either outside of our jurisdiction or that even on their face or with even a cursory view we see are retaliatory in nature. Or, I mean, frankly, a real easy scenario is we had a spate just this last year where persons in the Oregon State Hospital decided, watch, we can make our staff really nervous. And they just flooded us with complaints. This was not because there was a problem. This was because they wanted to make staff jump, and they did because it makes people nervous. We did, you know, we didn't jump to that conclusion initially. We came to that conclusion after we started looking at these allegations. I'm getting off track here. I apologize for that.
Just wrap up that answer if you could, so
yes.
We can move on. We have
yes.
Some other questions.
The reason is that a nurse wanted to find out information from you about an allegation and wasn't able to get that information, and I was just wondering how open you were with communicating information to the person who's being allegated.
Yes, thank you, Chair Richardson, Senator Moniz Anderson. Our process, and also in conjunction with the law, which says that the name of the complainant is confidential and the information obtained in the course of the investigation is confidential, we don't bring a licensee in until they must. We will write them and tell them if a case has been closed, if a matter has been closed. In other words, if they become aware of it, by whatever means, unfortunately, sometimes it's through gossip at work and rumor at work that they understand a complaint has been filed against them.
Hey, we're going to run out of time. I want to interrupt. Why would it be that way? If a complaint is filed against an attorney,
mm-hmm.
a letter is sent to the attorney with a copy of the complaint, and it says, there's a complaint filed against you. What have you got to say about this? And then the attorney responds, and they do an investigation, but it's all open, you know, because the person who's being complained against ought to have the right to have something to say. So you're saying that when a complaint gets filed, the person who's being filed against doesn't know about it unless he hears about it from gossip. That doesn't sound like a very open and forthright approach.
I'm sorry if that was what I communicated, Chair Richardson. If there is a substance to it, they will learn about the complaint through us because we will contact them and ask them for information about the alleged conduct. My understanding of the reason that these healthcare professions, other than the BME, they have a different statutorily required complaint process. Other than that, the other boards work the way the Board of Nursing does. My understanding of that is actually to protect the licensee. There are a number of panels, insurance panels, that if you've ever had a complaint filed against you, period, whether it was substantive, whether it was ever substantiated or not, is going to kick you off that panel. And the idea is behind it, as I understand it, I'm not trying to defend it so much as just explain my understanding of it, is that until it has been determined that you, the practitioner, have in fact engaged in conduct that was a violation of, in our case, the Nurse Practice Act, that all of this is an allegation. And there is a sense that the community at large would make more of it than simply what it is, which is an allegation, that the community should decidedly be informed when allegations have been proven to be true.
Okay, now we're confusing the community at large,
yes,
and the person who is being challenged. And it may be that this is something that you'd like to spend a little bit more time on to see the process and see maybe there's some adjustments that need to be made.
Sure.
May I ask a question about your job? How many investigators do you presently have who can do investigations?
8.
Okay. And you have 22,000 hours of investigations a year?
Yes, sir.
That's 2,200 hours of investigation per investigator presently. How many hours a day? I don't even ask this. Do you guys work? Is it 7.5 or 8 hours a day?
I calculated on an 8-hour day, Chair Richardson.
Okay. So an average full-time load is about 2,000 hours per employee if they're investigating full-time. And I assume that you've included in that 2,000 hours travel time other things, not just talking to people. I mean, is that 22,000 hours a full understanding of what's involved?
Chair Richardson, I calculated it on 2,000 hours per investigator per year. That is actually more than it should be, given that there are other things that they are required to do while they're at work.
Okay, and so with 22,000 hours, you're requesting two more investigators, so you will actually be cutting it down, but you're expecting that there will be an increase over time? One person more would give you your 2,000 hours each. You're asking for two more, and so with the basis for that?
Yes, Chair Richardson. The total of the 22,000, excuse me, with the 8 investigators we currently have, each of them working 2,000 investigative hours a year, gives us 16, which leaves us approximately 6,000 hours short of investigative work that needs to be done that isn't currently being done.
Oh.
So if you break that, that actually supports 3 new positions, not the 2 that we're seeking. My philosophy on this is to not just gin numbers and throw bodies, but to build this in a very incremental, methodical way.
Thank you. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have looked through your work and the way you came about this pretty closely, but I want you to help me understand. At the top of page 17 in the fourth sentence down, you say the last 798 investigations represent a concerted effort to update all application and renewal cases that had not been previously referred to the board for closure.
Mm-hmm.
Follow-up sentence, the application cleanup project was an anomalous event which we do not foresee occurring again in the future. If 25% of your casework is going away, or you don't foresee it happening in the future, you could eliminate, by my math,
that's good. Does
5,500 hours.
The 22,000 hours that you have indicated, that include this number?
No, sir. Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, this is the workload moving forward. That anomaly is work we were able to capture working backwards on some of the backlog that we had. We had 2 individuals retire. You'd be amazed what happens when you actually close down someone's investigative area. That's what that represents. I hope we never have such a backlog like that again. That is the thought, that it was an anomalous event that we won't have to be going through again.
So actually, you're saying that with a current staff of 8, assuming that you're not planning on a huge new number of increased investigations, if you've had the 22,000 hours in the past plus an extra 800 investigations, something's wrong with your numbers, because you would not be able to handle those with eight people.
Chair Richardson, my belief is the reason we were able to handle them is that last, in fiscal year 2003, we had a significant drop in the number of complaints that came in. You have updated information that you had asked for last time, so we have, that should be materials that were handed out to you. Mm-hmm. I think that gave us a little more time, and also I believe that some of the efficiencies that we have instituted have also helped us address this backlog. What I am concerned about is that the backlog, although we've made some inroads into it, it's still increasing. And that's not the trend we want to continue forward. You'll note that we were able to close, let's see, I've got it in here on page 20. Fiscal year 2004 was the first year we were actually able to close more cases than came in the door. It's the first year we started catching up, and again, I think that is due to the anomaly of the less cases. 90 less cases came in 2003.
We follow up. Follow up, please.
There's Hannah.
I don't quite understand. You're saying that 798 cases, they're not going to happen again. So that takes your 3,211 investigations down to 2,400 investigations.
Mm-hmm.
And 2,400 doesn't match the math and the computation. I mean...
If I may, the computations, pardon me, Chair Richardson, Senator Hanna, Representative Hanna. Sorry.
That's Senator Bates.
See how many configurations.
Bates never looked better.
Bates with hair.
If you, the reason I wanted to explain the fiscal year 2004 is the 3,200 is because that is much higher than what our normal workload is. And if you take the numbers that we are looking at to, and you're right, a more normal workload is around 2,100, 2,200, 2,400, somewhere around there. As we've noted in the past and in our budget materials, the typical workload is between 2 and historically is between 2,000 and 2,300. If you take these numbers and do the math on them, actually, this last year, you know, we're saying we do approximately 1,400 background investigations. In fact, in 2004, we did 1,451 conduct complaints. That's based on an average of about 700 per year. In fact, fiscal year 2004, we did 712. The other investigations, they're running about the same. So if you add that up, that is going to give us that 2413. The anomaly is being able to close down those cases, and we did that very quickly. Mostly it was administratively. These weren't cases that required. They just needed to be finished out. The work, most of the work, investigative work had been done, but they had not been taken to the board for completion. They had the effect, having taken them to the board for that final completion, inflated the numbers and gave you a false sense of what was accomplished that year. And I agree that truth in presentation is most critical. And I wanted to explain why this deviated so much from our normal work patterns. I hope that answers your question.
Any further questions? Please continue.
Chair Richardson, that probably explains why we believe those positions would be very helpful. The complaint intake coordinator position has been extremely helpful in keeping investigators on track with doing their investigative work and having a single point person. This has been very helpful to complainants, and we would like to see that increase to a full-time position. The numbers that we were just talking about are the ones that go to support the idea of two more investigative staff. And if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Or I can just stop talking right now.
Okay. Questions?
I guess I do have a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. if you cut the number down, if you use your math and you say there's 2,350 cases, and now if we kept the percentage the same or the number the same of the criminal background checks, that means 60% of your work is in criminal background checks.
Mm-hmm.
And those take how long?
Approximately 4 hours, Representative Hanna.
Okay, thank you.
Kim, looking at your management, I see that we have 7 managers per supervisors. No, 6 looks like. Am I correct? There's 6 managers in your organization out of the 40?
Yes, that's correct. 6 managers that supervise people, Representative
that's right.
Richardson. Right. We have other management positions. They are managed programs. They don't manage people.
Okay, so what's the total number of managers or supervisors, that you have in your staff?
I'm sorry, Representative Richardson, could you repeat that question?
The total number of managers or supervisors that you have in your staff of 40?
Representative Richardson, I think we have 12, total of 12.
Okay. So that means that you have one manager for every 40, that's 28. For every 2.5 staff, that's a ratio of 1 to 2.5.
Representative Richardson, of those 12, however, they don't supervise. There's only... there's only 6 that actually supervise people. I think there's I supervise 10 people under me. Then Kim Coprain, who is the investigations and compliance, supervises 13 people. The licensing and customer service person supervises 17 people, and then the accountant, the business manager, supervises 1 person. The accountant tech. Then the call center manager supervises 8. The other management positions are managing programs, like the human resource analyst. She is in management, but she doesn't supervise. The public information officer is a management position, but doesn't supervise. Our 4 nurse consultants are in management positions because they manage programs, but they don't supervise people.
All right. Thank you for clarifying that. Is there anything further you'd like to present to us today?
I think there were a couple of other pieces of information that we were asked to present to you today. We can continue to do that. Policy package 103 is the fingerprinting package, which we have talked about prior, so I don't know if we need to go into that any further.
Are there any other further questions on this? I think that you've given us the information that we need. We've kind of grilled you on some issues, and that's because that's part of our job to get down to the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. We've recommended that you join with other tenants and make sure that your landlords don't lean too heavily on you, make sure it's fair. And we appreciate all that you're doing. And, you know, the nurses are, we're not hearing complaints from the nurses in any way. But they also are not digging into this the way that we are, and so we're just trying to assure that everything is being handled in the way that's most efficient, most effective, and we appreciate very much all that you're doing, and I hope that you understand the spirit in which we've asked you the questions.
Representative Richardson,
thank you.
We absolutely do, and thank you.
All right. Just a moment.
Would you like to check if there are any questions?
Okay. That's something of our committee. Committee members, I'd like to ask if you have any questions about the fee ratification aspect of it, because that is going to be something that comes up for a vote. The current fee level was implemented for the current biennium, but we have the requirement to ratify it, and there is no increase in fees expected in the next biennium. And so that's something that we will be dealing with. Understood.
I mean, Bill, out of this committee.
Right. That's correct.
This week, tomorrow.
Oh, work session. Work session is scheduled for not till tomorrow.
Okay. That, I'm just trying to get the
timeline. As a medical board tomorrow as well?
Yeah.
Okay. We're also having a work session on the Board of Medical Examiners tomorrow. So it would be helpful if y'all would come. You'd have quorum. If you could see that some senators come, that'd be good.
Well, seeing as how I'm hanging in, the intrepid senator, and I'm 15 minutes late for session, I'll try to make sure.
You are the man. Thank you.
Truth is, I'd rather be here.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen.
Two real quick comments. One, do we have time for a public hearing on this, either with in connection with the work session, or is there going to be an opportunity for public comment?
We actually, that was part of today, and there's no one here that wanted to testify.
There's no one signed up.
No one signed up.
Well, is there?
No one signed up.
Because it wasn't any time.
Well, we've been here for 2 hours, and it's been an open session for the whole time. I'm sorry.
You didn't check for the list until the last 5 minutes, so at this point.
Okay. No, that's... we're here, and that's our fault. That's my fault. I apologize for that. I would not... I assumed that there was no one here that wanted to do public testimony. Thank you very much for the presentation. We now will open this to public testimony. If there's anybody that needs to leave, we understand, and
I'll talk individually.
I
know
Senator. Okay, I just want to make. I apologize for sliding you in that regard. I was under the impression that there was no one that wanted to testify, and we're willing to have it on the record if you'd like to have something on the record. All right. With that, we're adjourned for today. Thank you.